Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. How are you? It's so good of everybody to join us today. I noticed that maybe I didn't quite get the information off to our guest. He's calling already. He's already on. Okay. Good morning, Dr. Oren Levin-Waldman. How are you, sir?
Okay. Fine, thank you.
Well, I'm so thrilled to talk to you. I'm telling you, your latest essay has just blown me away, because even though I've learned of the two-party system here, I really never was engaged as much as I thought. I just had a sense of, yeah, it's a two-party system, and all the things that you mentioned about them make it very difficult for people even to recognize what's going on, especially because I'm more attuned to the European model. So what is the difference between the two, and why did we set it up the way we did here in the United States?
Well, the framers of the Constitution created a system that would basically militate against pure democracy, or what they considered to be mob rule, or what they said would degenerate into mobocracy. So what they created was a system of checks and balances. And by creating a system of single-member congressional districts based on a plurality of votes, the end result would be only the two strongest parties would survive. Only one person can represent a district, not four or five, as you have in various European provinces, so you have a multi-party system. And the result was, in the United States, anytime a third party tried to enter into the political arena, they usually fell by the wayside. Or if they were strong enough to overtake one of the two main parties, they supplanted that party. So the Republican Party started off as a third party, known as the Radical Republicans, that supplanted the Whig Party, which was the more conservative party. You had a Democratic Republican Party. They just simply dropped the Republican part of that and became what was now known as the Democratic Party. What we have here is what we call a broker party model, where the goal is to win an election. And parties don't really stand for much of anything. They just stand for whatever wins. And so that's why the positions of each party change over time, and they go back and forth. So at one time, the Civil Rights Party in the United States was, in fact, the Republican Party. This was the party of Lincoln that fought the Civil War and ended slavery. The Democratic Party became the Civil Rights Party when they passed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s. And then you saw a shift where opposition to those pieces of legislation became prominent in the Republican Party. So, positions of the parties change. They go back and forth as a pendulum. Whatever wins you the election, that's the position that you take. And the parties are traditionally non-ideological, whereas in Europe you have what's known as a responsible party model. And it tends to align itself with more parliamentary systems of government. You have multi-party representation in a particular province, and it's based on a threshold. So if your party gets a certain percentage of the vote, they get a seat in the parliament. And the result is you have parties that tend to be more ideological, the parties don't change their positions, the voters do. So if the voters change their positions, you simply vote the reigning party out of office and a new party comes into power. And that's what we call a responsible party model. Now, you could argue back and forth whether that's really responsible, but that's sort of the terminology we've come to use.
Well, in the juncture where we are now politically, wouldn't the European model suit us better? Because we're going, a lot of people in our society, across the breadth of the United States, don't feel represented. They feel ostracized or removed from the system, or don't have the financial means to influence the party one way or the other. Do we need to move toward the European model? Will that make more sense?
I don't know if it would make more sense. I mean, I think what you're seeing now in the nature of American politics is the progressive Democrats are trying to override the separation of powers and checks and balances. And they're trying to force party allegiance, which was never really the model in the United States. They're basically saying, Democrats, you must toe the party line, even if it costs you your seat. That's never been the tradition. The tradition has been members of Congress are elected to represent their districts, and they're supposed to do what their districts want them to do, not what the party wants them to do. Their first allegiance is to the district, not to the party. What you're seeing from progressive Democrats is saying, no, your allegiance has to be to the party and our particular agenda, not to your districts. Their districts are misinformed, or they're racist, or there's something else. But if push comes to shove, you must be willing to sacrifice your position in Congress, even lose the election for the sake of what we call the public interest.
Well, in your essay entitled By Design, the American Party System Follows the Broker Model, you mentioned in that essay that Thomas Jefferson was thinking that maybe we didn't have the right system, maybe it should have been more European. And why did that fail?
Jefferson was sort of a Europhile to a large extent.
Uh-huh.
Whereas Hamilton was more of an Anglophile. And Britain actually still also has a two-party system. It's less of the responsible party model. But Jefferson didn't completely reject separation of powers. He just basically thought, well, if you could basically have a party system whereby, you know, people in Congress support the positions of the president, then he could sort of override separation of powers and checks and balances. This was not exactly the Madisonian system by design. Ironically, he relied on on James Madison, the same author of the Constitution, when he was Speaker of the House, to sort of deliver Jefferson what he wanted.
Well, you also mentioned in prior essays that we've got a crisis here because the progressives or the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, they've got their own agenda, but they lost out when they voted against President Biden's investment, was a $1 trillion infusion of funding for different sorts of programs in the United States. Are they now marginalized forever? Is this part of the incrementalism that you've always mentioned that guides the American system?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, on the one hand, they're going to say we have a small victory, we passed the infrastructure bill. On the other hand, they're going to say, you know, we're still fighting to get the social spending package, Build America Back Better, whatever it's called. And so, you know, they're going to say that needs to be done now before we lose the majority in the House. We have to ram it through whether people like it or not because it's for their own good. At least that's what they're telling us. Yes, they seem to be missing the point that Biden has also scored significant losses and he's dropped in the polls, and people really don't support this agenda to a great extent. And I just saw something this morning that the CBO is basically saying it's not going to be, it's going to cost more than they're letting on, that, you know, the bill is assuming that if you beef up IRS enforcement of the tax laws, you'll bring in $400 billion a year in additional revenue. The CBO just came out and said, no, it's more like only $120 billion.
Mm-hmm. Well, we get a lot of rhetoric. Is that the problem we're hearing from government? Is that the same situation no matter what country we go to, no matter what the system?
You know, rhetoric is part of the political process, and it's part of the process by which, you know, those in power or the reigning political party attempts to persuade not only the opposing party, but the public in general, that what they want to do for the country is the right thing. And what I don't think you're seeing here is a lot of persuasion. That's really the whole basis for political power is persuasion. What you're seeing here is this rather self-righteous lecturing by a certain group saying, of course it's the right thing for the country. Don't you understand that? If you don't understand it, you must be stupid or something. But we don't have to explain this to you. And it's sort of, you know, evident. We don't really give you any details because we really don't want you to know what is really going on here. We're afraid if you know the details, you really will oppose it.
Well, you know, that's, to use an English expression, that's spot on. You know, that's definitely the way it is. I do feel like, excuse me, I do feel like they're lecturing me and I'm a child, but it's not quite that, I don't think, last I looked. So where do we go from here? Or are we stuck in this system that doesn't always subscribe to everybody's concept of what government should be? And then can that change? Can the American system evolve in a different way? Or are we just talking, you know, to a wall, and the system has worked for so many years? Will it continue to work like this? Or are we under, is the government concept under siege?
Well, you know, again, arguably you could say the system works when, in fact, you know, government is able to govern. Government can govern in a more simple society where there is really isn't much need for government to govern. When society becomes more complex and you have pressing issues and you have crises that have to be managed, and therefore you need policy solutions which require legislative action, then it becomes exceedingly more difficult to do that given the current political structure. The question is, do you want to rewrite the Constitution to allow for more efficient governance? But the price you pay for that is somebody's rights will be trampled upon, or at least various groups will feel that their rights, as they've historically understood them, will be trampled upon.
Indeed.
So that those are the costs of that.
Are we getting closer to that battlefield? Because, you know, there's so many people who feel that they've been displaced and that the system doesn't respond to their needs or their wants. And so the nation is divided. You see that with all sorts of different issues that have literally forced themselves, coerced themselves into the equation. So you hear about gun control and you hear about Black Lives Matter situations and people who want to come to the United States. And, you know, they may or may not even have, and then there's always the inoculation to the vaccine. There's just so many issues. How is our government contending with these sort of things, or are they're just oblivious to it?
Well, I mean, again, it depends on which side of the aisle you want to listen to. Arguably, again, it's not doing terribly well on a number of these fronts. We have a border crisis. It's taken its toll on how the public views the current president. We have a botched, you know, withdrawal from Afghanistan, which also has taken a toll on how the public and actually the world views the resolve of this administration with regard to a number of foreign policy issues. And I think that you have a president who claims he has a piece of legislation. He wants to accomplish certain transformational things, but he can't get it through Congress. It's not even clear he's even trying terribly hard to do so. I mean, you don't see him working the phones the way presidents in the past have worked the phones in attempt to persuade. You know, there's a famous book by Richard Neustadt called Presidential Power, published in the early 1960s. And Neustadt basically had worked in, was a Harvard professor of political science, but he had worked for a brief period of time in the Kennedy White House, and he basically said that the presidential power is the power to persuade. And he uses, he opens his book with a famous vignette where you have Truman on the eve of Eisenhower's inauguration basically saying to his advisors, poor Ike, he's going to come in here thinking the White House is like the military. He's going to command people to do this and do that and find out nobody listens to what he has to say. His point is the power of the president is the power to persuade. If you can persuade and you're successful in your persuasion, then in fact you have power. But if you can't, then you really don't have power. Now, he then goes on to talk about, give some examples where you had failed power, failed persuasion, like the forced desegregation of the schools in Little Rock, Arkansas, where you actually had to call the National Guard. He said this was an example of the failure of the administration to persuade. Now, again, one could argue that point because, you know, they did try to persuade them, but they just weren't listening.
Exactly. Well, I always got the impression, even though it was the Kennedy administration, I thought that was Lyndon Johnson that had the power of persuasion. Sometimes he really, it was tougher than I could have imagined the way he impacted people. And he pushed the buttons, and he was very successful at that. You don't mind expound on that? Because unfortunately, I've got doctor's delivery, and I've got to answer the doorbell, but I can hear it because I'm still with on the phone. So, what do you think? How did that work best? Did Lyndon Johnson do it? He convinced a lot of people.
I think Johnson was able to get a lot of Kennedy's legislation through because Kennedy was effectively a martyr. Had he not been assassinated, much of the legislation that has come to characterize the Great Society New Deal probably would not have seen the light of day.
Mm-hmm. So where do we go from here? Are we still in deliberation? Is the nation still in a quandary of where it is and where it wants to be? The squad may not be responding to them, even though they promised the world. And we're not able yet to deliver on those fronts. The black-white divide is and other colors, they just feel marginalized by the system. How do we traverse all of this?
Well, I mean, I think the squad demonstrates a fundamental ignorance of the American political system and how it's worked. And they also demonstrate a fundamental ignorance of his history.
You too. So, I'm sorry, I missed that for a moment.
I think the squad basically demonstrates a fundamental ignorance of American history and how the political system works in this country. That basically the system has always been built on compromise, and they don't seem to think it's necessary. And I think what they've learned, they've learned this from the woke industry, is if you simply call your opposition names, label them racist and a few other things, you sort of delegitimize the system as it has traditionally existed. So basically any attempt to override it becomes legitimate.
Well, it does seem, though, that they're waning in influence, or at least they're being marginalized and ostracized by the government itself. Can they sustain themselves at this point? It seems like Pelosi has outwitted them.
I think, well, it's a question. Maybe, you know, you look at the election, recent election in Virginia and also and the almost victory of the Republicans in New Jersey, the fact that this guy came so close to unseating this particular governor in New Jersey does not bode well for them and progressives. But I think, you know, they're going to argue, some people already have made the claim, that had at a minimum Biden's infrastructure plan been passed, it's possible that McAuliffe could have eked out a victory in Virginia. And basically he was trying to separate himself from the president, who says his poll numbers were in fact sinking. So basically, even though it came late, I guess there was a realization that at least among Pelosi and a few others, if we got to do something legislatively, even if it's not all we want, we have to do something to try to restore some of our fortunes and maybe stem the tidal wave that may become the 2022 election, where the Republicans really do steamroll the Democrats in the House.
Why does it seem that the Republicans are having a resurgence? Is it because of Biden's diminishing popularity or support?
I think it's more like, you know, the false pretenses under which he was elected. He wasn't elected to be transformational. He was elected to be calming. He was elected to basically restore order and some civility to the White House. He was basically elected to stop tweeting absurdities. He was elected to not be impulsive. He was basically elected because he was not Trump. And he was the anti-Trump. And basically people were rejecting Trump.
Yeah.
And I think what we have seen is a president who is so anti-Trump that he has to undo everything that Trump did, even those things that may be positive on the part of the Trump presidency.
Yeah,
but he has to undo them categorically, and he has to be more transformational. And he sort of surrendered on a lot of issues to the squad, even though he ran on a platform and said, I'm the moderate candidate. So basically the public is saying, we didn't vote for this. Just because you won the presidency doesn't mean you have a mandate to ram through the Bernie Sanders agenda.
Yeah. Yeah, he does seem to be in a quandary. I don't know where he's going. But was that because the demeanor in the nation was adversarial and still is adversarial? We don't seem to argue issues in a manner that makes it palatable for people to comprehend. And it's just like, okay, I'm on that side of the fence or I'm that side, but people are vacillating as well, aren't they? You know, you don't know where people stand today.
Well,
or they're becoming
like
emboldened with their positions.
It's been like that for decades. I mean, basically, even Dukakis, when he was running against the first Bush in 1988, basically came to the conclusion that if he could reduce his platform to 18 pages and a few bullet points and two-second sound bites, that was the way you could win an election. So even then, there was no discussion of the issues. We don't want to talk about this because we're afraid the public won't like what we have to say. And it probably goes back even further than that.
So are we moving away from the intention of the founding fathers, or are we getting closer to them? It seems that we're moving further and further away. We're not responding to the demeanor of the nation.
Well, I mean, the framers wanted what they called Republican governments with a small r, and they basically wanted government on the basis of deliberation and reason, and they thought that those who would rule should rule on the basis of reason and not irrational passions. They understood that passions had to be tamed, and one way to do that would create a structure where you would have a separation of powers. So no one branch of government would have enough power to ride roughshod over the rights of others, but you'd have need the cooperation of all the branches of government, basically you need a consensus. If you could achieve consensus, you would basically say, okay, that would be the public good. But they understood that as the country became more diverse, you expand the country and you bring in new groups of people, even the group of people for them was like actually a new state. You have that diversity. It's going to become even more difficult to achieve consensus. Therefore, you would have incremental policy making. And this was a good thing as far as they were concerned, because you basically would have a system by default which would protect individual rights. What they were very afraid of was this idea of irrational passions basically manifesting themselves in what they called mobocracy, the irrational passions of the mob. And it's not something they feared alone. You see this where, you know, Aristotle talks about democracy degenerating into mobocracy. So it goes back that far.
I guess so. I'm not exactly sure where everything is at the moment, you know, because when I reflect back on Trump, there was a lot of promise with him, and I don't feel that everything he did was wrong. I think there were a lot of things that he did were appropriate. I think the issues that undermined him seemed to be his rhetoric and his demeaning attitude and his finger pointing and however he presented himself, but he was really quite an autocrat, and Republicans today still seem to cling to his persona, and you're not a Republican unless you're for Trump. This idolatry just doesn't seem to work, does it?
I don't think it's going to work, and I think it actually could damage the party if they cling to it in 2024.
Yeah.
If not sooner.
Yeah, wow. So are we at a juncture now? Is that where we find ourselves? I mean, I never thought that America would be at a juncture because of governance, but the different communities of people who feel marginalized, they've been invited to the country, or they were here, like they're the indigenous people that are still here and will be here. A lot of people feel just removed. How do we respond to such a diverse group of people? Because it seems that the diversity that we always espoused was the strength of our nation is now seemingly undermining it, because we don't have an overlay of concepts and ideology to serve everyone. And since we're all people, maybe by different definitions, but we are people, human beings, why can't we get to a bottom line thing that can bring us all together? What's so difficult about that?
Well, it's very difficult to do that when you have a society structured on this idea of tolerance for diversity and rejection of absolutes. So basically, you know, the idea is that you don't really give weight to one group's definition of the public interest over somebody else's. So that was the whole theory behind a federal system of government, whereby, okay, each state could govern itself, particularly with regards to domestic policy, on the assumption that in many cases each state had its own respective political culture, whereas the federal government would have a structure where it basically would have limited function, because, you know, you didn't want one standard applying to all the different states. What the Civil War dramatized was that the states were poor protectors of people's basic rights, and that's why we basically ask for federal government to come in when it comes to issues of civil rights, because you want one standard that applies to all, but not everybody agrees on what that one standard should be.
Uh-huh. about when we moved into let's say Governor Wallace's Alabama to correct things, was the nation really beside itself over that, or did it seem rational that we should be protecting a black child for attending a particular school, or any school for that matter? Did that cause consternation among a good part of the nation?
It's hard to know how much consternation it caused. I mean, obviously, in the 60s, when all these issues are broadcast on television there, and people up north can see it, yes, it's something that's upsetting. But that's also what turned the tide in the Vietnam War, too, when you could see the death and destruction on the battlefield in your living room, because before you couldn't.
Right.
You had consternation there, too. That's where the protests sort of began. That in the lottery system for the draft. So basically, once you have a medium for mobilizing public opinion to your position, which was TV then and social media today, it's hard to know whether that consternation would have been there otherwise.
And we don't really know where we're going at this point, because the internet and social media is all over the place, as we always used to be. So are we coalescing towards a certain perspective, or are we still confused when you look at the entirety of the dogma that's espoused on social media and newspapers and wherever else? Is there a confusion that we recognize now, or we still don't get it?
Well, most of the public probably doesn't get it, or they feel that what's going on is the way things are all supposed to be, or they tune themselves out. I think that there are a lot of people in Congress who probably know better, but they go along because I think that's what their re-election hinges on. The other reason why members of Congress are so willing to toe the party line is because they fear punishment from the party leadership, and that affects their ability to represent their districts. So when basically you have the Republican Party in Congress talking about kicking off of committees members of the Republican Party who voted for the infrastructure bill. When in fact this bill was supposed to be labeled so-called bipartisan, or at least it was bipartisan in the Senate in terms of the bill that was negotiated. So the House Republicans are saying, well, it wasn't bipartisan as far as we're concerned. You were supposed to vote against it and denied Biden any win. We sort of had him on the ropes, is what they're really saying.
Well, interestingly enough for me, when I read your essay, I was really floored about how on target you were, especially in the sense that it spoke to, a national ignorance of the way our government functions and why it functions the way it does. Are we failing our population of students who are growing up and don't recognize the construct and the rationale for it being constructed that way? Is that what's causing part of our deviation and what we believe is right and what we believe is wrong, because we don't understand the structure and how it can work?
I think we understand it in a very simplistic fashion, at least in terms of how it's taught in a typical American civics classroom in high school. College, it gets to be a little bit more sophisticated, but not that much more sophisticated. If your basic course is American Government 101, it's basically a survey course on American politics and how the American government is structured and whatnot. Now, with requirements across campuses to include topics of social justice in all the topics on the syllabus. And then basically it becomes even more difficult to teach the traditional American political system without also mentioning that, in fact, it was built on a racist legacy, and how do you overcome that? So the system is basically working against you. Now, if you teach people that enough and they come to believe that that's true, or as opposed to a simply an opposing theory and allowing people to come to their own conclusions as to which is more valid theory, then you sort of undermine people's support for the system as we know it.
So is this like a do-or-die situation? Our politicians need to hold on to this structure because it works for them, because they will get reelected, because more people get reelected than get thrown out of office?
It would be nice if our politicians, when they swear an oath of allegiance to the U.S. Constitution to protect, preserve and protect it, if they actually knew what it actually said and they really read through it. I'm not sure that's happening anymore.
Yeah, I don't think so. So that's amazing. So we're really losing our way because we're not teaching the system to our population of children that are going through the educational system. And can we survive by keeping our people dumb by the lack of educational capacity that we should have or should be engaging in?
Well, I mean, it raises a fundamental question about the role of education in society. If the role is simply to teach people skills to function in the workforce, then you have a serious problem. If the role of education is to teach people to become good citizens, where they can think and be participate in the political process as good citizens, good informed citizens, then you have then you're putting greater responsibility on the role of education. It used to be that we basically said the purpose of teaching American government in high school was so you basically could learn to be a good citizen and participate. We also taught you a certain way because we wanted you to become loyal to the United States. We didn't teach you in American civics things like Marx and the capitalism was exploitation and things of that nature. We taught you it was all good. We taught you certain myths. You know, George Washington was honest and he chopped down the cherry tree and, you know, he was a fine, upstanding citizen. You know, you don't learn until much later. He was a slaveholder. He maybe may not have been the brightest bulb in the pack, that he was sort of being manipulated by people like Hamilton and others. But, you know, we don't teach you those things. You get that in college. But the values you have inculcated in high school are so deeply ingrained that if you learn these opposing theories, that the damage has already been done. You will not accept the opposing theories. You'll basically revert back to what you were originally taught.
And, you know, you're a professor. You know, you teach. Do you find that is evident in your classroom when you have a population of students that stand before you?
I found, you know, again, it depends what the level of students happen to be.
Right.
If students are you know, brighter students and they really are interested in learning, then you can basically challenge them on their preconceived notions and basically whatever they've learned over the years to think critically and assess what myths they have been taught over the years. But many students come in with this idea of one of the things that we've been teaching the American government for many years, that they come in with this idea that Congress works for the president. The concept of separation of powers is totally alien to them. And the idea that, you know, Congress is a co-equal branch of government. It's like, I thought the president tells members of Congress what to do. And if they don't listen to them, then they're not doing what they're supposed to do. This kind of thing. Or the other thing that, you know, teaching political science was that America, many students were astounded when they got their first C or even B.
Wow.
Or if they got a C because they thought, this is supposed to be easy. I thought if you simply read the newspapers and paid attention to the scorecard of, you know, who's winning, who's up and who's down, like at a football game, Democrats versus the Republicans, then it was an easy course. They didn't really understand. They just didn't know political theory and constitutional theory and, you know, the role of interest groups and, you know, political parties and all this. That was totally alien to these people. And, you know, they thought something like economics is much more difficult because it has math in it. And again, if they go to grad school these days in political science at a PhD program, oh, there's plenty of math and statistics in the program.
So this is a bit depressing, even though I'm not personally depressed about these things. I think they're just a challenge to set the nation straight. Not that I could do it, but certainly there are people with greater intellect and power of persuasion that I don't have. But are we moving in that direction? Have we come to that fulcrum where we realize, hey, we really got to hunker down. We got to get this right. We can't make mistakes as we have in history. You know, maybe since World War II, we've been floundering quite a bit. As a nation, it seems.
I think there's the appearance of floundering when the economy is not doing well. And if the economy is doing well and it's growing and people's wages are rising and people are living comfortably and they don't have to, they're not anxious about where the next paycheck's coming from, whether they're going to lose their job, or whether capital's going to be shipped abroad and things of that nature, then, you know, things are much better.
It's okay.
And there's no sense that the country is failing. Right now, it's hard to know. We're still trying to get out of this pandemic. We have a supply chain crisis, which is due to the pandemic. And you have a lot of other things going on. Then you have an administration, the Democratic Party, trying to ram through increased spending, basically with the claim it's not going to cost you anything. It's not going to result in raising taxes. It'll simply pay for itself. Now, I mean, this whole question of whether it's inflationary is actually a very complicated question. It's really not that simple. On the one hand, you know, if you have more spending by the government, that could lead to inflationary pressure. On the other hand, if you have spending on certain things which enable more people to enter the labor market, like childcare, you could actually see people enter the labor market, and in which case they're entering the labor market and they get paid, the revenues from tax receipts will actually increase. So in that sense, you know, it might pay for itself. I don't know if it's going to pay for itself to the extent that you think it will. And this is sort of like the old Reaganist argument that Ronald Reagan used to make and say, well, you know, if we lower taxes, then we will solve the deficit problem. Because if we lower taxes, more people are earning more money and tax revenues increase. Well, somehow the math didn't quite add up the way Reagan thought it would. The math doesn't quite add up here as well. The other problem that you have is if the Fed were to do what it's supposed to do, given inflationary pressure, it should be hiking interest rates already, which only adds to the problem of unemployment, which you don't really want to do right now.
No, so that's the reason that they're holding back. Because I never quite understood the role of the Fed anymore. But I didn't realize that that's part of their – it's what restricts them, you know, from holding inflation in check. So I didn't realize it would cause people not to lose employment.
it never traditionally restricted them, but it appears to be have become very restrictive, at least since the Great Recession in 2008. So, was a tendency, as soon as you saw any indication of inflationary pressure, you'd increase interest rates. Now, what was an indication of inflationary pressure? You know, if your unemployment rate dropped by even as much as 0.01%, that could be an indication of inflationary pressure. Now, the question, that's another question here. You could have a dropping of the unemployment rate with no inflationary pressure if the result is higher productivity. So you have more productivity coming from industry, even with low unemployment and rising wages, but that doesn't trigger inflation because you have greater productivity. But that's also because you have you're mixing labor with technology to get more output. So, you know, it's a more complex issue, and it can't easily be explained in a two-second soundbite, nor can it be explained by people who really don't know macroeconomics who are serving as press secretaries.
So when we look at the investment that's been passed by the Congress, you know, at the behest of the mayor, the president, does the infusion of money also create job opportunity for people, and will that therefore diminish the inflation because of productivity?
It can result in some job creation, but it's not immediate. So it's something that will happen over time. And so if you're looking for a quick fix, it's not going to happen immediately. And that's the problem that people don't really understand. So, we see you have these administration types coming out and say, oh, that will not add to inflation. That may be true over time. In the long run, because the market also readjusts. In the short run, there probably will be some inflation. Whether it's much more inflation than we currently have. But again, it will not be the source of the inflation. It may exacerbate the inflation that we already have. The source of the inflation is your supply chain crisis.
So was the supply chain crisis is there, but why can't we be a little bit more honest in the explanation of the impact of inflation and the impact of greater employment, and why can't we say it'll take a little bit of time? Why can't we let the people know so that they're a little bit more comfortable, because it's understood that the government knows what's going to happen and knows that it will get resolved over time? Is it that we're afraid we just don't want to invest that time as people?
I think what you're seeing here is the leadership of the Democratic Party in panic mode. They're saying, look, if we try to explain this to people, let's hit the pause button because we are concerned about inflation. If people really understand that inflation is a serious issue right now, they are not going to be supportive of additional spending right now. They're going to think of it as a luxury, and then we'll lose our momentum that we think we have, we don't really have, but we think we have, and trying to ram this through, especially before the next midterm election.
So is it a question of timing? You know, you're ahead of me with regard to the midterm election. Is it a question of timing, and the government hasn't timed it well? Should they have kept their mouths shut and waited till after the midterm?
Well, if they waited until after the midterm and they lost seats, then there'd be no chance of passing it. So everything is timing as far as those who are trying to get the legislation through.
Wow. So are you positive about the direction we're going? I mean, are there major issues? Is it really being discussed in academia, which you represent to me?
I don't know to what extent it's being discussed. I'm sure some people are raising these issues in classrooms across the country. But I think, I think the larger issue here is, to what extent are we committed to the constitutional system that we created? If we're not, because what we're seeing here is attempts to override a separation of powers and basically usurp various branches of government's authority. Basically, when a president says, I know what I'm doing is illegal, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I'm going to do it as long as I can get away with it until the Supreme Court tells me otherwise. That, I think, is a constitutional problem. It's a constitutional crisis.
Yeah.
And by all accounts, it should, in fact, be impeachable. That would be the very definition of an impeachable offense. But we won't see it because we're too much aligned with this party concept of, you know, we toe the party line right now, everything. And besides, if he's doing it because he's doing it to be the anti-Trump, then all, by all means, it must be acceptable. So we have that going on. And then you have a party saying, we don't really care about separation of powers. It's a racist construct, so we can simply ignore it and do what we want to do and try to ram this through. Then I think we have a problem. And yet you don't want to have a constitutional convention, which is what you really need to have if you really don't think your constitution is serving you anymore. Because once you do that, you open the doors to any possibility, even the construction of a system that's worse than what you already have.
Yeah. So where do we go from here, or are we just going to be meandering to no place?
Well, I mean, where we go from here will be reflected in the next election, I suppose, and in the results of that election. So you'll get a verdict on it. But they, of course, you know, can be spun in any number of different directions by different people. We still have people spinning the election a couple of weeks ago, basically saying, well, you know, this is only proof that people wanted more progressives, not less. Had you had more progressives and people were solidly progressive, then McAuliffe would have won. I don't know if that's true, but that's what they're saying.
That's what we're hearing. Wow. So, so we're just like stuck. Is that where we are? You know, the discourse is poor, the language is poor, definitions are not quite exact as they should be. But that's got to be the human tradition. Mm-hmm. You know, where people embellish or diminish because it suits them. How can, you know, who knows if I'm even smart enough to be able to conceptualize what's being said on a political platform, because most people aren't politicians. Most people aren't following all this stuff, but they could feel it in their pocketbook. And so is that where we need to start?
I think if politicians actually focus on the economy and the changes that have occurred, the Democratic Party has a serious issue here. They have a problem. The transformations that have occurred in the economy, the globalization and the loss of manufacturing jobs, the loss of the middle class, is really on their heads. They have been responsible for a lot of it, the policies they pursued over the last few decades. They don't want to own up to that. They don't want to deal with it. They can't deal with it, so they engage in identity politics. That's the problem. The Republicans, however,
Can't we deal with it? Why can't we deal with it?
They don't want to take responsibility for their role in that transformation. And they're also benefiting from the global economy. So why at least the politicians are, the elites are. The Republicans are equally responsible because they don't address the issues either. They simply fall back on their bromides. Well, you know, regulation, taxes, you know, lower taxes and less fewer regulations, then we'll all be fine, which is not really the case. What they have to do is, if they actually talked about these issues, how the economy has changed, and what needs to be done to restore the middle class, then I think you'd have a much more satisfying political debate. But you know, a lot of progressives have found ways around that too, to basically say, what do you mean the middle class? The middle class, is that not code for white? So we are basically, until we can start talking about, you know, bread and butter issues in a meaningful way, we are stuck.
Well, you know, I guess the white, if you want to call them the power white, I guess you could define it that way. But don't we need to have the capacity to invest in maybe bringing back a lot of the businesses that we've allowed to go abroad, and we still give them tax benefits? Shouldn't we be bringing back the jobs that we lost abroad? Or was that part of our, I don't know what do we think we were going to help the world out by investing abroad? Is that America's responsibility, or is America's responsibility to be here?
We were going
to
help
America first, in a sense.
We were going to help our investors by investing abroad. We were going to help ensure maximum shareholder value by investing abroad. And if we talk about bringing back investments here, if you're going to do it through the tax code, you've got a couple of choices. One is you offer them incentives through the tax code, which means that you're going to have to raise marginal tax rates to pay for those incentives that you're offering to business. This is part of the problem. This is the crux of the debate that you have right now, where people say this is basically unfair. Why doesn't the middle class get a tax break? And why does the middle class have to pay for it? And the truth is, when you start talking about what we're going to charge businesses for these new programs, that's patently absurd. They're not going to pay for it. They'll find ways to avoid it. And anyway, if you raise their taxes, you're going to pass the cost on to consumers anyway. So you're paying for it no matter what. Or what you do is you simply lower your taxes and have no corporate taxes at all, and simply have low flat taxes on consumer for individuals, or you have a consumption tax.
And corporations too, right?
I would say really you don't want to have corporate taxes on profits. You'd have individual income taxes, and they basically flat taxes low with no deductions whatsoever. Or you replace the whole structure with some kind of consumption tax, which is what most economists prefer. But that's not satisfying to progressives who feel that businesses have to be punished for their greed.
Really? Okay. Well, that I had not been, I never heard that verbalized that way, but I guess you're right. That's very frightening. So we're going to teach the poor child, you know, we're going to spank them? Oh, that's great. Wow. Well, unfortunately, what a great place to end our hour, you know. So I hope it's just frightening. Well, it'll move us on to 2 weeks from now when we talk about other issues. This has really been, for me, a very, very exciting hour, as always, with you. Thank you very, very much. Any last words from you?
Not this time.
Okay. Well, all the best to you, and thanks for making the time for our audience. What a pleasure, sir.
Thank you.
Be well. Bye. Well, there we have it, folks. None other than Professor Oren M. Levin-Waldman. Even though he's left, I think you'll find that his work, which is written work, is all over the place and really phenomenal. One of the books that he's written is called Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage Policy and Arguments for a Middle Class. Really breathtaking. It's issued by Palgrave, Palgrave. Another work from him, Understanding Public Policy in the United States. And this one is issued by Top Hat, T-O-P-H-A-T. And The Minimum Wage is how I was first introduced to him. Read the book, phenomenal. This is issued by ABC hyphen CLIO, so ABC hyphen CLIO. Really wonderful work, and this is a compendium of so much of what he's done It's called Wage Policy, Income Distribution, and Democratic Theory, again by Orrin M. Levin Waldman. It's in paperback. It's issued by Routledge, Routledge. It's one of the preeminent book publishing firm in the nation. And then he wrote the work called The Case of the Minimum Wage, Competing Policy Models. And this is issued by the State University of New York Press, so SUNY Press. And if you want to learn more about the professor's perspective on issues, and he is not obtuse, he is really on target, and his language is exceptionally honest in its depiction and explanation. I think you'll agree. You can go to his website, which is at www.econlabor.com. So that's E-C-O-N-L-A-B-O-R, econlabor.com. You can even reach him at his office at 914-629-6351. And I think you'll enjoy it, and it's a great introduction to him, and we'll see where that goes. Anyway, that's been a pleasure, and we'll move on then to our next segment, and what we're going to do for that is, bear with me a moment here, we'll take a quick commercial break while I find my way, and then we'll be right back. One second here.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio, Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
Can I get to wear a yellow lab coat?
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Well, welcome back. This is Westchester on the Level. My name is Hezzy Harris. We're going to cover a lot of international news now because it's become so pertinent. Bear with me a moment as I move on here. Evidently, police say that the Liverpool in England, a Liverpool attacker planned the blast for at least 7 months. It's amazing work. They did this so quickly. The man who died in a botched bomb attack in the northern English city of Liverpool on Sunday had planned the blast for at least 7 months, police said. They said that today. Iraq-born Imad al-Swaymin, who's 32, rented a property in the city in April and had made, quote, relevant purchases, end quote, for his bomb since, quote, at least that time, said Russ Jackson, who heads counterterrorism policing in northwest England. Al-Swaymin's improvised device went off in the back of a taxi outside a Liverpool hospital moments before Britain marked Remembrance Sunday last weekend. He was killed in the fireball while the quick-thinking taxi driver escaped with minor injuries after reportedly locking Al-Swaymin inside his cab. A complex picture is emerging over the purchases of the component parts of the device. We know that Al-Swaymin rented the property from April this year, and we believe relevant purchases have been made at least since that time, said Jackson. We have now traced a next of kin for Al-Swaymin, who has informed us that he was born in Iraq. and the failed asylum seeker suffered from bouts of mental illness that will, quote, form part of the investigation and will take some time to fully understand, said Jackson. Oswald Mean was taken in by Elizabeth and Malcolm Hitchcock, a Christian volunteer couple in Liverpool, for 8 months from 2017 as his appeal for refugee status played out. Elizabeth Hitchcock, told the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, she felt, quote, just so sad, end quote, and, quote, very shocked, end quote, by Sunday's incident, adding, quote, we just loved him. He was a lovely guy, end quote. Malcolm Hitchcock told independent TV, ITV News, that Oswald Mean spent time in a mental institution after being arrested with a knife in an incident in central Liverpool. The Times newspaper reported that the improvised device contained TATP, the same explosive favored by the Islamic State group that was used in the 2015 Paris attacks and the Manchester Arena bombing in 2017. The blast was the second terror-inspired attack in Britain in the last month after a British Minister of Parliament was stabbed to death as he met constituents in southeast England in October. The two incidents prompted the government on Monday to raise the terror threat level from substantial, quote-unquote, to severe, quote-unquote, the second highest, meaning an attack was highly likely. It has also brought Britain's asylum policy under scrutiny. At a time when London is seeking to tighten its borders, particularly against migrants crossing from France over the Channel, Home Secretary Priti Patel said that Oswald Mean had been able to exploit Britain's, quote, dysfunctional, end quote, immigration system and stay in the country, despite having been rejected for asylum, British media reported. His conversion to Christianity has also prompted discussion about whether some asylum seekers were using the process to bolster their stay in Britain. Liverpool Cathedral, where Oswald Mean was baptized in 2015 and confirmed in 2017, said it had, quote, robust processes, end quote, in place to determine a person's, quote, genuine commitment, end quote. Well, Malcolm Hitchcock told the BBC local radio he was convinced about Al-Shwaleen's religious conviction. Quote, I was in no doubt by the time that he left us at the end of 8 months that he was a Christian, he said. Unbelievable. We are going through major crises and we're being outwitted, whether it be in England or in so many other countries, by so many of these concocted, descriptions of people, which is really unbelievable. Now let's see what else is going on. This is very interesting. A Syrian star by the name of Suleyman has been detained in Turkey. It seems that Turkish police on Wednesday detained celebrated Syrian singer Omar Suleyman and questioned him about alleged ties to outlawed Kurdish militants, his manager told Agence France Presse. Suleyman was brought in for questioning in the southern Turkish city of Sanliurfa, I don't know that city at all, where he has been running a bakery since escaping Syria's decade-long civil war in 2011, said the manager, who asked not to be identified. Suleyman was being questioned over local media allegations that he had ties to the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, which is proscribed as a terrorist organization by Ankara, the United States, and the European Union. Well, the PKK has been waging a decades-long insurgency against a Turkish state that has claimed tens of thousands of lives. The manager said he expected Suleyman to be released later on Wednesday. Turkish media said that Süleyman was detained on an arrest warrant issued for, quote, membership of a terrorist organization, end quote, a charge that has seen tens of thousands jailed across Turkey in the past decade. Local administration officials in Sanliurfa confirmed that Süleyman's detention, but provided no other details when contacted by agents France Press. Süleyman has won international recognition for his melodic mix of dance and folk music, collaborating with artists such as Björk and the Blur's frontman Damon Albarn. He performed at a Nobel Peace Prize ceremony in Oslo in December of 2013 and starred in a benefit concert at the prestigious South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas earlier that year. The official video for his 2013 song, Warney Warney, has received nearly 95 million views on YouTube. A native of northeastern Syria who sings in Arabic and Kurdish, Süleyman has become a cult favorite of fans of international beats, performing to sold-out concert in his trademark dark glass and checkered keffiyeh scarf. He has featured on tracks of dancehall acts such as Acid Arab, and delivered lectures to international audiences about life in Syria before and after the war. His manager said the police were questioning Süleyman about a local media report alleging that he had traveled to a region of Syria controlled by a local offshoot of the PKK called the YPG. The YPG has been a key ally in the United States-led campaign against the so-called Islamic State group, further complicating U.S.-Turkish ties. It's amazing what happens all over the world. Well, there are other issues as well. Bear with me as a moment. It seems that the European Union should prepare for more migrant crises. That's what a border chief has said. The European Union should be prepared for more migrant crises like the ones on the Greek, Turkey, and Poland-Belarus borders, the head of the European Union's border agency advised in an interview. Frontex chief Fabrice Leggeri also said the agency was working with Polish authorities to organize repatriation of up to 1,700 migrants to Iraq by charter flights in the coming weeks. This is not the first time that the European Union has been faced with attempts at call it blackmail, call it geopolitical blackmail, call it a hybrid threat, Leggeri had said. He compared the current situation to the days of clashes seen in February 2020 when Greece tried to block tens of thousands of migrants who were deliberately let through by Turkey. It should open the eyes of people who have not understood that migration flows can be manipulated for political ends against the European Union to obtain something, he said. Quote, we have to prepare ourselves for situations like this, which can arise quite quickly, he said, speaking at Frontex's headquarters in a Warsaw skyscraper. Well, charter flights are planned. Created in 2004, Frontex has become the first European Union agency to build up a standing, uniformed force. It aims to have 10,000 border guards by 2027, up from the current 2,200 officers. While it is not directly involved on the Poland-Belarus border, it has around 100 border guards and 40 vehicles stationed on the Lithuania-Belarus border. Leggeri said that Frontex was also working with Polish authorities and the European Union to obtain necessary permission from Iraq to set up a series of charter flights for repatriation. We will have potentially 1,500 or 1,700 people to repatriate in the coming weeks, he said. A few thousand migrants are believed to be currently at the border between Poland and Belarus, including a group of around 1,800 near the Brzegi-Kuznica border crossing. The European Union accuses Belarus of deliberately bringing the migrants to the border as a way of putting pressure on the European Union. Belarus denies this and says that Poland should let them in. Legere said there were 25,000 Polish soldiers and border guards deployed in the area, as well as thousands more police. Poland has also said it will begin building a permanent barrier on the border next month, a plan that Legere said would help the work of border guards because it would reduce the number of irregular crossings and therefore of controversial returns. At least when there is a barrier, we are not accused of pushbacks against pushbacks because we know where the border is, and people physically cannot create a situation that is legally ambiguous for us, he said. A very annoying part of the job for border guards is when there are legal ambiguities, Legere had said. Well, Poland has been heavily criticized by non-governmental organizations for its policy of pushbacks, which have left many migrants stranded between the two countries, often for weeks on end in dire conditions and freezing temperatures. Frontex has itself, by non-governmental organizations, of failing to intervene in illegal pushbacks of migrants in the Greece-Turkey maritime borders. Look, these nationals have to apply to migrate and not just come in. I do not agree that they have a right, nor should Belarus be involved in any way, shape, or form trying to incur their assault of Iraqis, many coming from the Kurdish sections of Iraq, from coming into Europe. It's not a process. And it just can't be tolerated. And you don't see people running from Kurdistan or from Iraq into Russia. They wouldn't be tolerated, be shot at the border. You know, I mean, there are limits. This has to be understood as well. So it's not that I'm averse to helping people, but there's got to be some sort of procedure which should make it sane the way it's supposed to be. And, you know, it's not, and that's a problem. Now let's just see what's going on here. There's a Cuban dissident by the name of Junio Garcia in Spain after a failed demonstration. Well, Cuban actor, playwright, and dissident Junio Garcia, one of the organizers of a failed protest on the island nation earlier this week, is currently in Spain. Spanish government sources said that today. We confirm that he has arrived with his wife on a tourist visa, a government source advised. Garcia is the founder of Cuban opposition group Archipelago, which has called for protesters to take to the streets dressed in white. A planned demonstration in the capital of Havana on Monday was thwarted as opposition leaders were detained and security forces flooded the streets to prevent people from gathering. Garcia also saw his plans to protest solo in Havana on Sunday blocked by the authorities. And on Monday, he was prevented from leaving his house by state security agents. I know that they are going to do something, or rather everything possible, to prevent me from being there. Of course, they are going to try to arrest me. They will maybe set up surveillance outside my home to keep me from leaving, he said, during an interview with Agence France-Presse in Cuba last month. As of Wednesday, reporters have been unable to contact him, and he has not posted on social media. Archipelago planned Monday's protest after being galvanized by unprecedented countrywide spontaneous demonstrations that broke out in July. Now, the rallies were fueled by growing anger at economic hardship and demands for freedom but a crackdown by security forces left one person dead, dozens injured, and 1,270 arrested in a country where displays of public discontent are rare and risky. Well, born in the eastern city of Holguin, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Garcia has long known was only long known in the world of the arts world for his plays as well as television and movie scripts. But since November 27 of 2020, when hundreds of artists demanded more freedom of expression at a protest in Havana, he has taken on another role, one of the faces of a new generation critical of the government. Archipelago, which claims to have 30,000 members inside and outside of Cuba, on Tuesday called on protesters to continue their struggle by wearing white, carrying white roses, creating personal videos, and banging pots and pans at night until November 27, 10 days away. It blasted, quote, the extreme militarization of the streets. More than 100 activists besieged, arbitrary detentions, forced disappearances, repudiation, violence, threats, coercion, and hate speech. Among those arrested was an archipelago coordinator by the name of Daniela Rojo, whom the group had reported had been missing for days, the organization said. Her social media accounts have vanished, and it is not known where she is being held. Cuban officials who deny holding political prisoners consider the opposition to be illegitimate and allege it is financed by Washington. Oh, my God. Now, let's look at what's happening in Armenia and Azerbaijan. Bear with me a moment. Armenia-Azerbaijan ceasefire holds one day after the deadly border clashes. A Russian brokered ceasefire was holding on Wednesday at the Armenian-Azerbaijani border, officials said, a day after deadly clashes between the arch foes sparked fears of another flare-up in their territorial dispute. On Tuesday, clashes between Armenian and Azerbaijani troops left 8 soldiers dead in the worst fighting since last year's war over the long-disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. The 6-week conflict, which claimed the lives of more than 6,500 people, ended last November in a Russia-mediated deal that saw Armenia cede swathes of territory it had controlled for decades. Tuesday's fighting ended in the evening after mediation by Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu. 7 servicemen died and 10 more were wounded in the clashes provoked Tuesday by Armenia, Baku's defense ministry said, adding that the situation at the border, quote, stabilized on Tuesday evening, end quote. Armenia's defense ministry said one Armenian soldier was killed, 13 were captured by Azerbaijani forces, and 24 servicemen were missing. It said, quote, the situation at the border's eastern sector was relatively calm and a ceasefire agreement was being respected on Wednesday morning. But there are calls for constraint. Armenia's Prime Minister Niko Pashinyan on Tuesday accused Azerbaijan of, quote, targeting Armenia's statehood, sovereignty, and independence. Baku said that Yerevan was responsible for a, quote, large-scale military provocation, end quote. Armenia appealed to its Russian ally for military support under the Collective Security Treaty Organization Pact, which obliges Moscow to protect it in the event of a foreign invasion. Quote, given that there was an attack on Armenia's sovereignty territory, we appealed to the Russian Federation to protect Armenia's territorial integrity, end quote, Security Council Secretary Armen Grigoryan said on Tuesday. The same day, a Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed the situation with Pashinyan, by phone. The Kremlin said in a statement and agreed to, quote, continue contacts, end quote, on the matter. Before the ceasefire was announced, the European Union and the United Nations called on both sides to cease hostility. European Council President Charles Michel on Twitter calls for a full ceasefire, end quote, while the United Nations urged Baku and Yerevan to exercise restraint. Baku and Yerevan are the capitals of the respective countries. Now, the French Foreign Ministry in a statement expressed its, quote, deep concern, end quote, and called on all parties to respect the agreement that were reached, the agreements that were reached in November 2020. Since last year's war, both Armenia and Azerbaijan have reported occasional exchanges of fire. Ethnic Armenian separatists in Nagorno-Karabakh broke away from Azerbaijan as the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, and an ensuing conflict claimed around 30,000 lives. Unbelievable. Now, let's look at some other issues. Bear with me a moment. And this is very interesting because before we spoke about asylum seekers, and inside Greece's closed Samos camp, a European model for asylum seekers. Well, this is a report from Alexis Kefalas, Natalie Savarikas, and Stamos Prousalis. It's part of the FOCUS program on France 24. And listen to this report. Bear with me a moment.
Welcome back to the mirror.
And no, you're not alone.
Bear with me a moment.
It's not just a mirror. It's an unstoppable community.
Okay, we'll get this in a moment. This is a commercial. Okay, we'll get started now.
Daniel arrived in Samos nearly 2 years ago. He is still waiting for his asylum request to be processed. 2 long years that have started to take a toll on the young man from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Hey, this camp is good compared to the other camp. We sleep well here. We're just hoping we will get a positive outcome, that our asylum request will be approved and allow us to start a new life outside the camp.
He's already making plans and considers himself among the lucky ones after learning that other asylum seekers on makeshift boats continue to drown in the Aegean Sea.
He arrived in Greece despite very difficult and dangerous conditions. Whenever we hear that our brothers and sisters die, it makes us very sad.
Sadness is also visible in the eyes of Alice. She arrived in this asylum seeker camp this October. Her journey started in Sierra Leone and took her through Iran. What she experienced has left scars that will take years to heal.
They put me in a big house where some men come to rape me. Then one day I decided to run away from the house. I met some people with their different nationalities. I decided to follow them in the bush, walk in the night, clean mountains. So we are walking. Also, I'm very tired because clean mountains, no food. If I said I want to eat, unless they rape me before they give me food. So I want to stay in Greece because I know that Greece is safe for me.
Safe, but also isolated from the rest of the world. This ultra-modern center is located in a deserted area northwest of Samos. Endless barbed wire, security gates, x-ray scanners. The 360 refugees here are divided by origin in color-coded containers. They aren't allowed to go out after 8 p.m. Greek authorities say they're aware these restrictions are strict.
Security is essential for our residents because they claim to have left their countries for security reasons.
Greece is on the border between Europe and Asia, and the East in general. So its role is to protect European borders.
This 43 million euro center was entirely funded by the EU and has a unique monitoring system with cameras linked directly to Athens.
This is the drone with sound and camera. It provides us with footage, but the ground patrols can also access them. And these are the augmented reality glasses which receive our instructions while on the ground. The camera systems recognize what is suspicious. They recognize knives, arms, and see what is happening. Then they sound the red alarm if it is very serious, or amber if it's less serious. Then we send instructions accordingly.
Just a few kilometers from this steel fortress lies the old camp of Samos, right in the heart of the town of Athens. It was hastily evacuated last September.
Rats here were the size of cats. Refugees would live with insects, rats, and snakes. There was a whole range of issues, too. Xenophobia, geopolitical conflicts, alcohol making its way into the camp, causing a lot of tension and drama.
Every night, this aid worker monitors the Turkish coast right across the harbor of Samos to help with new arrivals. But since the Taliban regime seized power in Afghanistan, Greek authorities have increased border controls, fearing a new wave of refugees.
Refugee boats regularly arrive here. The sea in front of you that seems magnificent is actually a cemetery.
Another four camps, built on the same model as Samos, will soon open on neighboring islands.
Okay, let's move on to something else here. Bear with me a moment. Well, I see we're at the 11:30 hour, so that'll be the end of our time with you today. Normally we would stay on till 12, but just don't have time today because of other responsibilities. So hopefully you'll join us tomorrow. Let me just quickly look because I don't remember who we're having tomorrow. Bear with me a moment. I have to look at the calendar. It should all be in my mind, but evidently I don't remember what's there. Bear with me a second here. Where is it? Okay, let me just quickly look here, see who we have for Thursday. Oh, yeah, we're going to be again speaking to John and Laurie Wiles. And they're the dynamic duo, and so they're just a lot of fun. John and Laurie Wiles, they are the automotive reviewers for the Yonkers Tribune, and so I look forward to speaking to them. They have arrived back from the United Kingdom. They were there for almost 2 weeks' time, and so I miss them as usual. And I look forward to speaking to them then. Okay, so that seems to be where we are today. Let me go back to our screen, and we'll wish you a good day. And thanks again for being with us today. Goodbye.